On this week's 20 Minute Takes, we speak with author Dante Stort. He's the author of Shoutin' in the Fire, an American Epistle. And this week we talked to him about his writing, his inspirations, and the ways that his faith, stories, and the land all informed his journey home. Come join us for this conversation on 20 Minute Takes. Dante Stort, thank you so much for joining us on 20 Minute Takes.
All right. Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
Dante is an author, and we wanted to have you on as we're featuring the voices of Black authors. But can you tell us a little bit, before you became an author, what did life, what did ministry look like for you?
Oh, good. You know, nobody ever asked me that question.
Is that right?
Like, for real. Like, nobody ever asked me my question, or nobody ever asked me kind of what, like what do you dream of being, like, after being an author? You know, things like that. But I'm kind of living the dream. I tell people all the time, you know, I'm living the dream right now.
You're living the dream.
But actually, you know, I am a military spouse. So I am, my wife is in the Air Force. And much of life before becoming an author or even being on staff at Tabernacle Baptist Church here in Augusta, Georgia, was about me like working at Enterprise, and I was a barista. First I was working at Enterprise and was a barista, and I was in seminary and still kind of in seminary. I've been taking a long route. I transferred two times now to where I'm at Emory University.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, life was about like looking up specialty coffee, reading books and writing essays and trying to, you know, develop my own kind of voice and style as a writer. So I've been writing for a little minute now, at least since 2016 publicly. And so before actually the book coming out in 2021, I still was writing and reading and making coffee and doing things like that.
Yeah. Nice. Nice. Your book, Shoutin' in the Fire, an American Epistle. What was it that sparked your writing of the book?
So much of my story was being rooted in how I was reading Black texts, and I was now actually legitimately Black around, back around us and Black people. I was going back home. And even, you know, my trying to make sense of my own failure and the ways in which, like, you know, vulnerability and honesty was really a key to my own liberation and my own self-love, to use the language of June Jordan, and developing of self-respect. So much like so many people who were trying to figure out how to deal with the kind of ongoing nature of police brutality, of this country's addiction to Black suffering, the ways in which like white vigilante violence was still, you know, very fundamentally the law of the land and the practice of the people. So many of us were trying to make sense of that. And I was just trying to join the long tradition of Kiese Layman and Jasmine Ward and Sarah Broom and Darnell Moore and others who kind of write in this kind of memoir type way, but also trying to like lean on like James Cone and Toni Morrison and Toni Capone Barr and Katie Cannon and the likes of those voices to help me make sense of my story and give me better metaphors to understand my faith and how to practice it.
That's amazing. So one of the questions that I want to ask you is, I love all of these different historical and some of the greats of literature that have been your conversation partners in this. And I think there's sort of a way that you unpack these greats, Toni Morrison, Baldwin, in the way that other Christians unpack scripture. Can you tell us a little bit about the, like, how does that dialogue happen for you? And how does that happen for you?
Yeah, well, it's already happening. You know, it's and in some sense, like I'm receiving a tradition and an ongoing conversation that's already happening. I was sitting down the other day talking with a family friend. He was my granddaddy friend. My granddaddy just passed. We had the funeral the other day on Saturday, and Mr. Earl is I want to say Mr. Earl is 81. And we were talking, and he asked me, you know, have you ever been on a cruise? And so I'm listening to him. He's holding my hand. I said, nah, I've never been on a cruise. And he says, well, all right, if you ever go on a cruise, make sure you pay attention to the water. And I said, okay. And he says, every time I've gone on a cruise, I stopped and I paid attention to the water because somebody either swam or drowned. And because they did that, I am here today. And literally, like when I thought about that conversation, particularly about paying attention to the water and particularly paying attention, you know, to looking, how he was saying, looking at myself, and he ended that conversation with, I'm a proud Black man. And I thought about that in just that conversation that we had. Very much that conversation is a reflection of the ways in which I believe the divine is at work within Black stories.
Yes.
That wherever we find ourselves, that these stories are stories that are to generate meaning,
yes.
You know, and these stories are not going to be great stories. Like, as far as like, you know, good stories, like mm-hmm. to pay attention to the water is to pay attention to death. It is to pay attention to the ways in which white supremacy, has murdered us and raped us and pillaged us and plundered us and used us as both chattel and capital. But then also what he is trying to get me to think about is paying attention long enough to the people who survive. And it was in the context of this. He says, you know, that a lot of people talk about the great generation, the greatest generation was the people after the war. And then he says, that's not the greatest generation. He says the greatest generation are the people who survived the voyage.
Oh, wow.
That's the greatest generation. And so for me, when I think about this conversation between those voices and the people who made us, I think it was Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, when you look at every sail, you can see your ancestors marked upon your life. And for me, as a reader of the Bible, I think that, you know, being invited into this conversation of people who have gone before us, you know, they looked at their ancestors as stories, as metaphors to understand and ground them in the land, ground them in their own collective story of how they live and move and have their being in the world. It grounded them in the rituals that helped sustain them as a people. Those stories that were able to look at, you know, the hard ways that they have lived, but also the lives that they have made and what they have made of the world and what they have made of themselves.
Yes.
And they looked at it and they chronicle it in books and anthologies, the book of Jeremiah, the book of Hosea, these chronicles and testaments to tell of the revelation of the divine in their stories. And for me, when I read the book of Nambara, when I read the stories of Aluyuda Ekiano, when I read the language of Anna Julia Cooper, mm-hmm. Or the poetry of Nikki Giovanni, mm-hmm. Or the lyricism of Toni Morrison and James Baldwin and Tony K. Bambara and June Jordan.
Yes.
For me, these are also these names that also, in some sense, to speak in the language of Octavia Butler, Lauren in Parable of the Sower, this is Earthseed, the book of the living, and the stuff that keeps us alive. And so for me, I think just like those of the past, particularly those who stories are chronicled in the Bible, or even those whose stories are chronicled in our theological and literary tradition, they were always trying to look at their own selves and look at their own people to say that there is something here for us to learn and listen to, that will help us embody our faith in the story, that will help help us achieve freedom and liberation, and more than anything, achieve life and life to the full.
Wow. So in the same way that the Bible is this collection of stories that help reflect and unpack and help us understand God, in the same way you look at both the art and the writings, as well as the life stories of these other folks to also reveal and unpack.
Yeah, indeed. Like who could, for me, when I listen to Mr. Earle speak about the topography of the land and the kind of social and political geography of going and living in post-war rural South Carolina, or going through the 60s and the 70s. And then here was a man who's sitting down telling me what he's going to miss the most about my grandfather. And that was the intimacy of conversation and the ability to be still enough to listen to one another. But then here is a man who also says he carries a copy of the Constitution in his pocket every single day. And he reads the Constitution every single week because he wants us to know that there is something beautiful and divine about being Black and have survived in the way that we have survived. But then also, this is a man who sits and tells me me that I am tired of Martin. He's 80 years old. And then my grandmother comes and sits beside him. And I see my grandmother as she parts ways with her husband in this just hours earlier as the casket is being laid down. Here is my grandmother, as Elizabeth Alexander would write in her book, The Light of the World. Here is my grandmother laying her hands on the love of her life. And we're gathered together in the space to send my granddaddy to the grave in the most extravagant, beautiful, solemn, and sacred way possible. And I look at these moments and I say, this is where the divine is. And how could one not spot the divine in these moments? I mean, people may disagree with that, but at the end of the day, for me, I'm not as concerned with what people think about us or convincing them that we have something to offer. Because in some sense, we think about public conversations on theology, if we think about the academy, and even if we think in philosophical language of epistemology, oftentimes people have not taken seriously that the way that we name the world, see the world, inherit the world, and pass on the world to one another, these black worlds,
yes,
which has both beauty and burdens and triumph and sorrows and testimonies and love and life and violence, just the humanity of our stories. People in the academy and these theological conversations don't often think that we are worthy starting point. And so for me to sit there, to pay attention, to write, to chronicle these stories is me saying that this is a worthy starting point, and there's something here for me to listen to.
Wow. That is amazing. I'm getting goosebumps as you're talking, as you're talking about this worthy starting point. And your memoir, I've heard you mention that it's the experience of it and the memoir itself is something of a journey home. Can you tell me a little bit about that journey home and maybe some of the things that were surprising to you both on that journey or as you find yourself in a place that's home?
Yeah, I think for me, when I think about to write a memoir, my grandma would always tell me, boy, you ain't lived enough. So I think there's something audacious. There's something beautifully audacious about being 29 and journeying to the land of memoir. As my friend who's a writer, he told me over and over again, he said, you wrote a risky book. And it wasn't until months later that I understood the risk of journeying into memoir, especially, you know, being young. And one of the things, especially, I'll start with the thing that's been surprising. The thing that's been surprising is that the more that I read, the more that I write, the more that I grow, the more I realize I don't know and that I must read and that I must write in order for me to grow into the person that I want to become. The surprising thing about this journey home is that oftentimes when I think about going home or you know, think about traveling back to South Carolina after leaving, you know, trying to leave Georgia, Georgia being a metaphor for the ways in which, like, I was involved in the white church and me going back home and trying to pay attention to my grandfather, my grandmother, my mama, my daddy, my cousins.
Yes.
You know, the surprising thing is that, you know, so much of this journey of writing has been the healing that I've been looking for.
Wow.
Because so much of my own story, Shouting in the Fire, is a story of a young man who runs. It is a story of a young man who continues to run to people, to things, to places, in hopes that this young man will finally find something that he's been looking for all his life, and that is affirmation. It is the space to be free and to be whole and to not feel as if that this young man has to perform for other people in order to simply hear on the other side, I see you and you are loved. And so if I think about my own journey of journeying home and kind of getting some distance from myself and kind of looking at myself as a character within this own story, this young man travels to so many different places and hurts people along the process and gets hurt along the process. But then all of that hurt and all of that hurting, at some point when I was able to be still enough to listen and to learn, then I was able to make sense of who I had become. And in some sense, the monster that I had become and the ways in which I was surrounded by people who, in some sense, did not care how they treated other people as long as they felt as if their theology and their religion was right. And so they used the church, they used the Bible, they used faith, they used books, they used the academy, they used all these things as weapons instead of worlds to be explored. And so for me, when Philando Castile and Alton Sterling is murdered, and then Donald Trump is in office, and now, you know, I'm deeply immersed in white social space and white social life. The journey home was a messy journey home. It was a journey where, you know, I had my bags packed and they were full and I had to let some baggage go. And in some sense, I journeyed home, not running, but limping. And realizing that even if I limped my way through, at least I made it to where I found myself and made it home to actually where I wanted to go. And so then that's all wrapped up into the surprise of it. But then also another surprise was kind of, you know, what my friend, we was doing an event together with Mahogany Books, and shout out to Mahogany Books, a black owned bookstore in DC.
Yeah.
Shout out to, Ramunda and Derek, the owners, love them so much. We were doing an event with them on the book, and he asked me a question that he says, you know, he asks everybody that he does events with. He says, if you were to look at your 10-year-old self, what would you tell that person?
Mm.
And then immediately my mind goes back to this picture that my mother gave me of me around like 9, 10, 11.
Uh-huh.
And I am in front of the Pentecostal church. I used to air guitar and I'm in front of the church air guitaring. And I realized that what I told him in that moment is that one of the things I'm most proud of, I would tell that person that I'm so proud of you that you never stop showing up for yourself and trying, at least trying.
Yes.
You failed in many ways, but then you did get to a place where you were able to listen.
Yes.
You know, you failed at homophobia. You failed at sexism. You failed at misogyny. You failed at, you know, being a black dude in a white space who is a weapon against black people. But then also, young man, that you learned that even in the failure, even in the running, at some point you're going to have to stop and face yourself. And you actually did it. Even if, like, you still bear the scars and bear the wounds, you still find a way through the church, through ministry, in the public, to remind yourself and others again and again and again, that what you learned back then actually allowed you to become who you are right now. And so that indeed is a surprise that I did not give up on myself and trying to show up for myself and for other people in public.
Oh, that is amazing. I want to take that question that Derek asked you and actually give you a little bit of a twist on it.
Yeah.
You know, as you think about future generations and the ones that you are investing in and the ones that you're raising, what is it that you hope will be true for them? Is there a truth that you hold that they will hold within themselves?
Yeah, I hope for my children and for their children and for the children who look like them, or even for the children who don't look like them. I just hope that the world that we give them, that they are handed, is a little bit better than the world that we were handed.
Mm.
You know, so much of my theology, you know, is not dogmatic anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even so oftentimes, you know, I really don't even care about doctrine. Because at the end of the day, these kind of frameworks, you know, even though they can be life-giving, at some point there's a limitation to a framework to actually shape a life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, life is not meant to be shaped by frameworks only.
Mm-hmm.
Life is about embodiment and the lived experience of faith,
yes.
The lived experience of story. So for me, when I look at my theology in Jesus, so much in public, you know, I'm kind of being known now for like this kind of thing of Jesus and James Baldwin,
mm-hmm.
you know, black theology and, yes. and black literature.
Yes.
So much of how I think about Baldwin and Jesus, Baldwin says this line, at the end of, In Search of a Majority, he says, you know, that we need not lead, that the world is before you. You need not take it or leave it the same way you found it.
Mm.
And Jesus says the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy.
Mm-hmm.
But I have come that you may have life and life to the fullest. So much of my understanding of a theology of life is about a theology of the future and the ways in which life will be constructed
wow.
for them. the conditions that they live in,
yes,
the world that they are handed.
Yes.
Will they be handed, as the end of the movie of the Book of Eli, you know, where Denzel Washington lays down and from memory, he recites this sacred story because he has ingested it so long. So he has practiced it over and over and over again, that the only mission he has is in life is to survive just long enough so somebody can hear what story brought him over. And so for me, I too think about that. I think about my children and why do I buy all these books and why do I buy this artwork and why am I trying to write and why am I trying to preach and why am I being invested in all these things I'm being invested in. And I realize that so much of it is, yes, for me and for us, but so much of it is for them. As my friend would say, we're trying to build a canon. Yes. I want them to have a canon, not just simply of literature, but a canon of love that they can pull from again and again and again. Because this, as I write in my book, literally in the chapter on my granddaddy, which is called Flooding, at the end of Flooding, I literally say, you know, I think about my granddaddy, he has dementia. And I say, even when he has lost, and he has lost so much, when we hold on to those stories, he is still found.
Wow.
So when our children wake up again, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, 200 years from now,
yes,
and we're gone,
yes,
and we've passed over,
yes,
the stamp both of the divine and of the beauty of Blackness and of Black life will still be something that they hold on to that keeps them living, that keeps them pressing the world to be what it can be and can become.
Dante Stewart, thank you so much for sharing your story and showing us that your story is a beginning and an end in and of itself. I think you have lived out this promise of the canon that you are wanting to impart to the next generations. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us here on 20 Minute Takes.
Yeah, indeed. And thank you to those who are tuning in. Lately, over the last few months, every interview I've done, at the end, I want to thank the crowd who's showing up, you know, in this medium. We see you. We thank you. It's not easy to show up and tap in and things like that, but you're doing it again and again and again. And we want to thank you, and we want to continue, you know, to create things that you feel, you know, that sees you, that keeps you inspired, that protects your vulnerability and your honesty, and that loves you in ways that you desire. So thank you to the crowd that pays attention.
Minute Takes is a production of Christians for Social Action. Our music was created by Andre Henry, and our show is produced by David DeLeon. I'm your host, Nikki Toyamasito. And if you want to find out more about our work, visit the website at christiansforsocialaction.org.